evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. According to the U.S. Secret Service, one package sent to the New York home of George Soros was found on Monday. A package at the Clinton residence in Westchester County, New York, was found yesterday. Another one addressed to the Obamas was found early this morning, along with a package found at CNN offices in New York, one at the office of Congressman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, addressed to former Attorney General Eric Holder, all of which contained explosive devices. Is America descending into the politics of rage, or is this the flow of a cycle, ebb and flow? Also, what is it about America that stimulates this behavior? For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He is the author and two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist with more than 20 years of journalistic experience. He is former Washington Post bureau chief and award-winning foreign correspondent on two continents as well. As a former radio and television producer of Chicago Public Media's The American Life, This American Life, John Jeter. John, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Always a pleasure, Dr. Leon. Always a pleasure.
Professor Joanne Freeman from Yale wrote an interesting piece in The Atlantic where she says, quote, "Anger has a peculiar power in democracies. It feeds on raw emotion with a primal power. Fear, pride, hate, humiliation, and it is contagious, investing the like-minded with a sense of holy cause." She continues, "Such is the dynamic of politics in the time of Trump. The politics of outrage is fast becoming a political norm, each flare-up lowering the bar of acceptable rhetoric and producing an upswing in belligerent posturing." John, is this fast becoming a political norm, or is this America being America?
That's a great question. You know, I think it's the latter. Clearly, it's this is. Look, there are three crimes recognized by all of the major religions as crimes against humanity, meaning that there's never any justification for them. They are slavery, they are genocide, and they are rape. The United States was built on all three. Violence is going to happen. There will be blood in this country. That's always been the case. That always will be the case, at least for the foreseeable future. What we're seeing now is political crises or economic crises breed political crises, and we're seeing the culmination of that. Trump is a symptom of the problem. He's not the problem in and of himself. And I would argue that Barack Obama and George Bush and Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and all of these this has been a bipartisan effort to produce a political economy run on isolation and fear. There should be no one should be surprised that we're seeing a surge in violence and a surge in violence. I think that really blankets this country is something we should be wary of. No one can predict the future, but it's something we should all be on guard for.
You can go to France and there is terrorism, but not at the level that you see and not of the type that you see in this country. You can go to Britain. You can go to Denmark and Sweden, and you can go a lot of places in the world and you don't see the gun violence and you don't see this type of political violence, the Mura building and the Unabomber and, you know, these types of what we're seeing now, these explosive devices being sent out today. Talk about the history of America and what is it about this country that makes it so unique with the violence of this type?
Yeah, France does have a history of violence and political violence that is similar, but by no means identical to what the United States sees. And it's for the exact same reason, really, which is that they are a white settler colonial state. The difference is that their colonialism was done abroad. The colonizing of the United States was mostly done, completely, done domestically here in the United States. So really, you know, this is the culmination of 150 years, a cycle that ebbs and flows. I mean, this is an effort by all institutions of the state, the government, the media, especially the media, our educational system, to quarantine the most radical and most class-conscious elements of our society. Always the African American, because we are the most liberal voting bloc, most liberal bloc, politically speaking. And then those who have been our allies, be they recent Jewish immigrants in the 30s and 40s, be they the communists, be they the anarchists earlier in the first part of the 20th century. There's always been this effort. But well, by doing that, by sort of corralling the African-American and the radical political elements of that, what you do is you really mute the conversation. And I would dare say that no country in the modern era, in the media age, is as misinformed and misguided and as the United States. And therefore, the violence tends to be scattershot. In other words, what you see in France typically is this kind of call and response, which I'm not defending that necessarily, but there is sort of the state is violent towards typically people of color, colonized populations, many of whom are in Algeria or whatnot, and come to France and carry out these acts of violence. And then there's a response from these people against the state. Here we have, for instance, probably this is going to turn out to be some reactionary, some conservative, listening a little bit too closely to what Trump is saying, although this is what Trump has always intended, because, of course, as I think we talked about it on your last program, they prefer a race war to a class war. So someone's listening to Trump, they decide they're going to, you know, hurt the liberals, Bill Clinton, George Soros, Hillary Clinton. Well, you know, you and I think, are real leftists, and we understand there's nothing liberal about the Clintons.
Right.
You're not doing any damage to liberal politics by sending, you know, explosive materials to the Clintons. All you're doing really is exactly what the ruling class in this country wants, which is you've really scapegoated only one faction of the people who oppress you.
I was in a conversation earlier today and talking about European countries and former and current either colonizers or neo-colonialists. And I mentioned France, I mentioned Britain. And I said, yeah, I realize that as former colonial subjects of darker skin have moved into the former colonizer, that initially when that was happening, that wasn't a problem. But as the racial dynamic, and I hate to use the term race, but for the sake of this conversation, as the racial dynamic shifted, then you started to see violence. And so I was saying that that is a relatively new phenomenon in those countries, as opposed to what has been going on in this country since it was founded.
I would agree with you to a point. I do think it's newer in places like France and in the.
That's my only point.
Yeah, I agree with you to a point. I think that it maybe is, there's maybe a slightly different layer to it as well, which is that, again, this country, you know, as Zora Neale Hurston said, the writer Zora Neale Hurston, she said, you know, violence is their religion. She was speaking really of the white settler, the European settler.
Mm-hmm.
Violence is their religion. And I think because this country was founded on what it was founded upon, right?
Mm-hmm.
Rape, genocide, enslavement. Those things are in our DNA, as Kendrick Lamar would say, right? I think in France you've actually had, at varying points in time, a very class-conscious society. Now, that's not all that surprising, because they were a very homogenous society,
right?
And still are,
right?
Although less so than they used to be. And so, you had this class consciousness. Working class people knew who their enemy was, and it wasn't another worker. And so, you had the Paris Commune, the revolution of 1948. You had the Russian Revolution,
right,
in 1905 and 1970, because you had a different conversation going on.
Mm-hmm.
Here, the elites, the ruling class, has always perpetuated this myth that your enemy is your neighbor.
Right.
Especially that darker skinned neighbor.
There you go.
I think that has deepened the level of violence here.
What about the individual nature of the American ethos, the promotion of the rights of the individual? And so that then makes it easier for someone to decide, I'm going to take this upon myself to act out violently towards those that I have issue with.
Right, right. You know what it is? It's really very reminiscent of what we saw the colonizers do in Africa. For instance, pitting one tribe against the other.
Mm-hmm.
In Africa, they tend to be one African tribe against another, one black against the black, Hutus and Tutsis, by giving one preferential treatment and hiring and housing and education, all these things.
And usually it was the smaller tribe against the larger tribe.
Right.
They gave favor to the smaller tribe knowing that they would be uber violent.
That's right.
In order to protect their position against the larger perceived dominant threat.
Right, right. And they couldn't quite replicate that here, but the impact is very similar, where they pitted the majority against the minority. And they have encouraged and promoted this violence, and they've done it really for 150 years, very strongly. So, you know, this is no surprise what's happening now. And frankly, no one can predict what's going to happen, but my guess is it's going to get worse, probably much, much worse before.
We know it will, because there are 7,000 Latinos coming from Central America, and they're coming through Mexico, and they're coming to kill us and take over. Quickly, I want to look at the violence that we saw in the 60s. A lot of that, as I saw it, was government initiated. The assassination of John Kennedy, the assassination of Dr. King, the assassination of Robert Kennedy. I put all those at the feet of J. Edgar Hoover and his COINTELPRO program. But then we had, you know, other Medgar Evers and others who I believe were assassinated through individual means, like Swerner Goodman and Cheney, and we can go back to Emmett Till and in the late 50s. So talk a little bit about that 60s period compared to where we are now.
Well, I think there's a lot. There are far more similarities than differences. What we saw there again was that the 60s happened at the end of, you know, America very much, its political economy very much operates in cycles, where the tribes, typically blacks and whites, but now we're seeing Latinos being added to the mix increasingly. But typically we see these cycles of sort of racial reconciliation, progress, and then for whatever reason,
backlash.
Fall out. Right, backlash. We fall out, and then rinse and repeat, right? So what happened really in the 60s was the culmination of this era of reconciliation, which of course is not to sort of say that we've ever had any kind of, you know,
peace
or utopia in this country, and certainly not for blacks. And there's always been racism. It's always been deeply ingrained. But we had a moment at least where there was some conversation happening that started roughly around 1933 in the depths of the Great Depression. And you saw the Congress of Industrial Organizations come together and organize blacks and whites in these unions, which were radical and which were, and this is what most people don't understand, which were heavily influenced by this sort of African ethos of community, community values, and doing what's best for the community as opposed to the individual. That started to fall apart gradually in the 60s, came to a boiling point with the riots that began with the Watts riot in 65 and exploded with the assassination of King. And then—
Wait a minute, you just skipped over the entire bloody summer.
Well, yes, I did. You're right. And let me say, and this is another thing, too, that bloody summer of 68, you can compare that to the bloody summer of 1919 and understand.
Well, that's the bloody summer I was referring to, was the bloody summer of 1919.
Okay.
So, because that was white frustration against black progress.
Right. That's right. And I think we should really consider what happened in those two bloody summers, 68 and 1919, because I think what we have here, or at least the potential, is this perfect storm that's bearing down on us, not just black frustration, because blacks have never been so dispossessed. I mean, we actually have not accumulated any appreciable gains in wealth since the Emancipation Proclamation. So you've got that on the one hand, and then you've got this white frustration that is worse than I've ever seen in my lifetime. I'm 53. I've never seen white people so disenfranchised, so alienated from their communities as they've been now. And of course, in this country, as misinformed as it is, you know, they're going to lash out more than likely at us, at the Latinos.
And to that point, as you said, misinformed as it is, I think that's very, very important, because their ire and their anger is greatly misplaced and intentionally so.
Exactly.
When you look at the core of the Donald Trump supporter, I call them, those are the white folks that the real white folks left behind.
That's exactly right.
And have convinced them that, you know, this whole idea of the American dream, the whole myth of the American dream. And now these people, a lot of these folks are going to restaurants or they're going to the bank, and the people that they're interacting with have darker skin than they have different accents than they have. And they're sitting there frustrated trying to figure out why they're having to mortgage their present to pay for a future.
Yeah.
Because their wages have remained stagnant for the last 20 years.
Right.
And because the industry is closing. They can no longer work that Ford job on the assembly line, own a home, and support a family and retire.
Right.
And they've been convinced it's those 7,000 people from Honduras. It's their fault.
Right. Right. My sister says something that I think is brilliant. She says, you know, whites who support Trump are going to be just as disappointed in him as blacks who supported Obama. What I take away from that is something that Jean-Paul Sartre, the French, mm-hmm. great French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre said. Hell is a place where by design, no one's needs are met, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can see from that and a society which has always cherished violence and guns and always promoted, always exalted the individual, right? The pioneer. You can see the very real possibility of a conflagration, right? No one's needs are met. No one's they're not met because they're not heard. No one can. There's no real communication. There's no real conversation. And so I think I'm not speaking out of school here to say I think the social scientists have a word for this. When people can't communicate through words, they communicate through violence. I think it's called phatic communication. Well, you know, again, we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but especially if that other shoe drops, right? Everyone's predicting there's going to be another crash. And for the last 30 years, each crash has been successively worse. Well, the last one was pretty bad. It was worse than anyone since the Great Depression, 1929. And so, you know, there's a very real possibility that what we're looking at here could be really quite epic. You know, there's that possibility. And so I think, you know, the question I'm not sure if I've used this before, but I'm going to use it now. The question for us is very much like my favorite French film, La Haine or Hate. And the protagonist talks about, you know, French society is very much like the man falling from a 100-story building. And as he passes each floor, he says, so far, so good.
Mm-hmm.
His point, he says, is it doesn't matter how you fall. It only matters how you
land.
The question is, how are we going to land in this country? And I think the verdict is out. The jury is out. We don't know.
And the unfortunate thing in all of this is so much of it is by design.
I would argue all of it is by design.
Well, okay. I think we're arguing percentages.
Right.
100 versus 99.59.
Right. Right.
Wow. Hey, John Jeter, man, thank you so much for your time today. I greatly appreciate, as always, when you bring it to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much, Doctor.
Look forward to bringing you back, man. Hey, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is embarking upon the first trip by a Japanese prime minister to China in 7 years. He faces challenges on the strategic front, but may find gentler economic common ground to traverse as he and Chinese President Xi Jinping face off against a Trumpian gale blowing across the Pacific. What does this mean for these two countries, and what does it say about relations with the United States? For this, we turn to my next guest. He is an internationally recognized journalist and political analyst whose focus is on U.S. foreign policy in a global system of monopoly, capitalism, and imperialism. Caleb Maupin, as always, man, welcome back, and thanks for coming to the Critical Hour.
Sure. Glad to be here.
So, Caleb, these two Asian giants, the world's number two and number three economies, are regional strategic rivals with a really, really bloody history. But they are increasingly finding themselves confronted by Donald Trump in U.S. foreign policy and an assault on their trade practices. So what do you see as the basis of this upcoming meeting?
Well, you have to put this in context. So first of all, let's back up because, you know, we're not in that part of the world. We may not understand how deeply the hatred flows, but, you know, we know during the Second World War
between China and Japan.
Yes.
Yeah.
Horrendous atrocities were committed. But more recently, you know, you'll notice every few years, the Japanese right wing will try and change the school textbooks to try and gloss over the atrocities that Japan committed during the Second World War. And then on the Chinese mainland, you will see riots. You will see people go out and attack Japanese consulates and just be so full of rage about that. There's a long-standing history, you know, you can go down the line. I mean, the Chinese Revolution itself, one of Mao's first political activities when he was a young man, was boycotting Japanese goods and certain products. Back in the 1920s, up until, you know, the Second World War, and on and on. I mean, you can go down the line. For a long time, Taiwan was occupied by Japan, which China felt was, you know, it still maintains, and U.S. foreign policy, it is part of China. I mean, there's a long history of just you know, bitterness between the two peoples. And this explodes every so often. You'll see another riot over textbooks or something to that effect. So now we have to put this in another context, which is, you remember the Obama administration was really excited about the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Mm-hmm.
That was a treaty. And basically what it was an anti-China economic alliance. The idea was that Japan and South Korea and Vietnam and all these different countries were all going to sign on with the TPP with the United States. And part of being part of the TPP meant they would get all these trade benefits if they agreed to exclude China. The TPP was an anti-China economic alliance. And the Obama administration, it was on their agenda. They very much wanted to pass it. They wanted to put it through before Obama left office. And you'll notice one of the first things that Donald Trump did when he took office was cancel the TPP, was scratch it. Now, he said a lot of bizarre things. He said things like, well, China's going to join the TPP. Well, no, they weren't. Anti-China alliance, in essence. So that was very odd. It was very distorted. But regardless, Trump, you know, he campaigned against the TPP. He brought it up in campaign rhetoric about how it hurt the jobs of U.S. workers. He canceled it. So now Japan, that was all excited about the TPP, they were going to be one of the main beneficiaries of it. They've lost out on a pretty big opportunity. And there's a lot of anger at the Trump administration for pulling out of the TPP, because in a way, the TPP was going to give them a big boost over their rival, China. It was going to basically have all the countries that signed on to it do business with Japan and the United States and not China. It was a huge win for Japan, the TPP. Well, Trump has canceled it. So now we've got a situation where these two countries, the long history of not getting along with each other, you know, centuries of hate and anger between the two countries, horrendous atrocities committed by Japan, you know, so much history there. We now have a situation where, for the first time in 7 years, the president of Japan and the president of China are going to meet, and there's talk of escalating the trade relationship between Japan and China in response to what is being seen as a U.S. retreat from the global stage. In that situation, you know, instead of Japan and the USA versus China, well, now Japan and the USA are not exactly seeing eye to eye. They're not exactly an item. So this presents an opportunity for China and Japan to expand their relationship.
Before leaving Japan, in a speech earlier today, President Abe vowed to upgrade the troubled relationship with leaders' visits and increased business. I think he's also traveling with about 500 business people. He said that China and Japan are responsible for regional prosperity and that he would import more foreign labor to overcome the country's labor shortage. He also said that Tokyo will halt overseas development aid to China. Given China's economic size, that's outmoded. And instead, he suggested updated formats for economic cooperation. I mean, this sounds, in terms of rhetoric anyway, that they're trying to align their interests because the enemy of my enemy is now my friend.
Absolutely. The Trump administration is almost the complete opposite of the Obama administration when it comes to relations with Europe, relations with, you know, other global superpowers, even countries that are historically aligned with the United States, whether they be NATO countries, whether it be Japan, South Korea. The Trump administration, yes, it has escalated this trade war with tariffs against China. You know, there's wild threats against Iran, but they've also, you know, been pretty hostile to traditional allies of the United States. And that's important to keep in mind. And that in response to this sudden layer of distance between Europe and the United States, between traditional U.S. allies and the United States, in response to that, we're seeing a lot of these allies, these longtime allies of the United States, getting a lot friendlier to countries that are considered to be rivals. I mean, not only is you know, Japan having this kind of rapprochement with China, where, you know, we know the Vatican. Recently, you know, the Pope and the Chinese government, which have been at odds for a long time, they signed an agreement. So now the Catholic Church is going to recognize the priests on the Chinese mainland that are selected by the Communist Party. The Communist Party picks the priests for the Catholic Church in China, and the Vatican will recognize them.
I want to say that China just recently, if they haven't sent them, they're about to send two of those priests to the Vatican.
Yes. I mean, and this is historic. This is a historic moment. And I think that in a lot of ways, you can put it in the context of the division between the United States and Europe. Europe is being disrespected and feels like they're being economically pressed on and hurt by the Trump administration and by the United States. So they're obviously looking for friends somewhere else. And they see China. Maybe they shouldn't be so hostile to China. Maybe they shouldn't be on board with the U.S. campaign against China. And that seems to be the polarization that we're seeing in the world. And you can very much put Japan into that category. What is also interesting is that, you know, Japan, they tend to be particularly hostile to North Korea. You know, Japan was the occupier of Korea for a long time, committed horrendous atrocities there. And Japan has been, you know, one of the forefront of, you know, beating the drums against North Korea. And the fact that there seems to be the Trump administration, you know, there was talk of they were going to de-escalate things with North Korea. And then South Korea and North Korea have been getting along much better. They want to build these railroads. But now we've got John Bolton and other forces that are trying to block potential railroad connections between the North and the South. You have to wonder that the North Korea-South Korea situation, where the Moon Jae-in administration in South Korea wants to, you know, get closer to the North, and then the United States obstructing that, you have to put that situation into the hopper as well. And also, let's not forget that Japan hosts U.S. military bases. I mean, Okinawa, very important U.S. military base in the Pacific. And as much as, you know, there may be distance between the USA and Japan economically, the USA still, you know, has its troops on Japanese territory all across the Pacific, not just in Okinawa, but in other places. And that Asian pivot that the Obama administration really emphasized of placing more U.S. military personnel, more U.S. military hardware in Asia, that hasn't stopped at all. I mean, that has increased. And in fact, Trump has been emphasizing the need to sell more military hardware in Asia. So there's many different factors that you could put into it here, but the fact that Japan doesn't feel like this TPP is ever going to happen, that Trump seems to have just killed it on his first day in office, 2016. Trump came in there and killed the TPP. It seems that in that situation, that Japan seems much more open to getting along with China. However, their military relationship with the United States is very, very well intact.
I'm glad you brought up the military issue, because the day before he departed for China, Abe made clear in a speech to the House of Representatives that he's going to push ahead with a revision of Japan's pacifist constitution. While Japan's self-defense force is already powerfully armed and increasingly active around the region, this will enable a wider scope of action in conflict zones and would enable Tokyo to enter alliances with nations other than the United States. And you add to that, earlier this month, you had U.S. and Chinese destroyers involved in an unsafe encounter at sea. A Chinese destroyer was trying to run off an American ship from what China considers its own territory. Then you had back in May, you had China's military announce that it had dispatched warships to challenge two U.S. Navy vessels that sailed through the waters in the South China Sea that China claims as its own. So, as Japan is widening its self-defense force concepts and capabilities and looking to enter or at least creating the space for it to enter into military alliances, and China is stepping up, that's got to be a huge concern for U.S. foreign policy, particularly as it relates on the military side.
Well, the important thing to remember about the South China Sea is that the reason that China is very anxious to secure the South China Sea and make sure that those seaways are secure is because most of the oil that is imported into China comes via oil tankers on the South China Sea. And that's one of the biggest weaknesses that China has. You know, they've got some oil coming through pipelines from Russia. They're expanding their use of natural gas. They're actually really pushing hard for what they call new energy vehicles, electric cars in China. But the main reason for this is that China produces very, very little oil domestically, nowhere near enough. And China, you know, this is the manufacturing center of the world. So much production going on, so many factories, so much steel, so much copper.
Right. So it's not just quickly, it's not only oil, I was going to interject there. It's also they need those shipping lanes with the whole Belt and Road Initiative, and they're trying to be able to be sure that they can get their goods out everywhere in the world and they can get the materials in from anywhere in the world. They need that shipping lane.
Yes, they need the South China Sea to be secure because Shanghai, you know, the port there is very, very important. The entire Chinese economy with all the industrial manufacturing that goes on there, all the oil and energy that's being brought in, all the exports, that's very, very vital. And that seems to be the issue, is they want to secure the trade routes and they want to make sure that that area in particular is protected. And that's also, I might add, why China has been working with the government of Nicaragua to build a new canal to counter the Panama Canal, because the Panama Canal territory is still technically under the control of the USA. Now, the USA, the agreement is they let any ship go through there. There's no issue, but if there were to be an escalation of tension, that could foreseeably change. So to have the government of Nicaragua, the Sandinistas, the Marxist government there, to have an agreement with them to start building a canal to counter the Panama Canal, a canal that would be under the control of a government that's much more friendly and sympathetic to China, built by Chinese corporations, that would enable them to have a kind of a backup plan, a way that they could get shipping going through North America or across the American hemisphere without having to go through the Panama Canal if the United States were to start giving them difficulties. And many people look at the crisis in Nicaragua and the protests that were going on, where our U.S. government, our U.S. media was basically cheering for these people that were going through Nicaragua and killing police officers and burning buildings. Many people look at that and say that was an effort by forces aligned with the United States and our intelligence agencies to prevent that canal from being constructed. And every time China begins to move ahead with that project to build that canal, suddenly you'll hear noise against the government of Nicaragua. You have to put everything, they say the world is much smaller than it used to. And very little that goes on around the world is not connected to global events. We're much more globally integrated than ever before, and we're starting to see that play out. You know, I mean, there's a crisis in one country. It can be very, very well linked to a crisis in another country and a crisis in another country. And that you know, it's very hard to just have isolated incidents taking place in an isolated country. You know, global forces seem to manifest themselves in the domestic affairs of a number of different countries.
Let me stop you there. Caleb Maupin, as always, man, you bring it. And that's why we are so pleased and grateful when you come to the Critical Hour. Really appreciate it, man. Take care.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
All right. Hey, folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is still more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you are listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Civilian death toll keeps mounting as Saudi coalition continues to target civilians. For greater insight into this, we turn to my next guest. She's the editor-in-chief of Inside Arabia, Elizabeth Myers. Elizabeth, welcome back. And thank you for always coming in to the Critical Hour.
Great to be back.
Before we get to the issue in terms of Yemen, you have been following and been very much, very close to the issue with the murder of a Washington Post journalist, Jamal Khashoggi. Tell us where you are with this and in your take on the current situation.
Well, I think after 3 weeks now, we finally have an admission that there actually was murder. We were expecting a huge announcement of the, quote, naked truth yesterday by the Turkish president. Unfortunately, it was a bit of a letdown, in my opinion. I was expecting somehow more detail, more evidence. As they say, they have evidence of audio and video. And then even more importantly, the body. But really all we got yesterday were a lot of questions. The main one is, where is the body? And then I read another report, I can't remember which who reported it, but that parts of the body had been found in the garden at the consul general's
house. I heard that this morning as well, yes.
Yeah, so it's a pretty gruesome tale. I think more details are going to come out. I really think that there's a strategic interest for the Turks in not releasing their information and kind of keeping everybody on hold and keeping the Saudis especially on hold.
I would not want to play poker with President Erdogan because he really seems to be playing this hand and playing it well.
Yeah. So I guess it remains to be seen how we get any kind of accountability in this situation.
Well, you're starting to hear and read more stories about the Saudi royal family and their commission, I don't remember the name of the council that is responsible for selecting the next heir, that they're looking for a way to get MBS out and that he is on his way out. And that seems to be Erdogan's mission. And he seems to be trying to play his hand to that end.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a bitter struggle. The fact that MBS, as they call him for short, has gone to such lengths to consolidate power into his own hands, including last year's arrests of the royal family members and princes. There's going to be a big power struggle there.
He detained them in the same hotel where he's now holding his investors conference.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Davos in the desert, the Ritz-Carlton. there's a kind of sweet irony there, I guess, for him. I mean, really, I kind of look at this whole thing, especially the Khashoggi incident, as this is a message from him to the world and primarily to the United States that Saudi Arabia is no longer little brother. Saudi Arabia is a major player on the world stage, equal to the United States, because this particular thing has been so brazen and done in the consulate itself. You cannot get away from that connection. And with a regime that's basically an absolute monarchy, there's nothing that happens without orders from the top. There really isn't. If you look throughout history, you're not going to find, oh, there was this kind of rogue killer in our consulate who just, you know, the interrogation went awry and we had to cut his fingers off because, you know, he was grabbing at something.
15
or,
of them.
Right. Yeah. So the truth will out in the end. Mm-hmm. It's just really a question of when and what the consequences are going to be in that power struggle. And I'm hopeful that the U.S. will do the right thing. And that's kind of a segue to Yemen.
Exactly. It is very interesting when you listen to mainstream media analysis. They may mention Yemen in the conversation now that that Jamal Khashoggi has been murdered. Yemen will factor or filter into the conversation. The atrocities that are being committed by the Saudi coalition might be discussed. The U.S. involvement in all of that won't be discussed. The most recent story, civilian death toll keeps mounting as the coalition continues to target civilians. It seems to be getting worse, not better.
I think that's true. And I think actually there has been some more mainstream coverage of this now. I just heard this morning on public radio, they interviewed two people, one of whom was the UN coordinator for Yemen. And she is the person who said just last week that we're now looking at the worst famine, not just the world's worst humanitarian crisis, but the world's worst famine in 100 years. And this is in, you know, a part of the world that there is food there. It's a question of the infrastructure is now no longer there, plus the blockade has really isolated the people from the main routes by which food and medicine come in. And not to mention the cholera.
The world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis. And that element to me must continue to be articulated is that it doesn't have to be this way. It didn't have to start this way. And it doesn't have to continue to be the way that it is. Unfortunately, there isn't enough pressure being put on the Saudi government in order to change.
Well, and in fact, just the opposite. There's a lot of support going on for the coalition, the Saudis and the Emiratis, the coalition forces, in terms of U.S. intelligence, continuing U.S. support in terms of logistics, in terms of refueling planes, all of the things that we've been supporting over the last 3 years, all in the name of basically confronting the supposed Iran proxy war that's going on.
Reported by Ahmed Abdul Karim from Mint Press, the Legal Center for Rights and Development in Yemen, a non-governmental organization monitoring human rights violations immediately after the most recent events, has said that the ongoing Saudi-led military campaign against Yemen has resulted in the death of 15,185 civilians, among them 3,526 children and 2,587 women have sustained injuries and are currently suffering from a shortage of medical supplies and treatment resulting from the crippling Saudi land, air, and sea blockade, which you just mentioned.
Right. And these numbers are, they're even more horrendous than what was reported in the UN report that came out at the end of September, which documented this sort of level. It wasn't as bad then because we've had yet
right.
another
And this is still going to be an undercount.
Yes, I'm sure it's an undercount, partly because it's very difficult for information to get out from there. One of the things is journalists are not allowed to go in there.
Mm-hmm.
And just the what I was listening to this morning on the humanitarian crisis, the transportation difficulties of even getting children from a middle-class family to a hospital now are insurmountable, especially when you have this going on, the roads. Now they're targeting highways specifically and throughways to make sure that people just can't even travel around. The situation is very dire.
And how it is, I have to reiterate, how it is there can be so much focus on MBS, on the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, as horrific as that is, and this is still not getting what's happening in Yemen with the support of the United States government is still not getting the attention and the pressure that needs to be applied is not being applied. And there's another front in the war. The Saudis are deporting, from what I read, workers, sending them back to a country where all they're going to do is starve. 8 out of the 10 Yemenis expelled from Saudi Arabia who were interviewed by Ahmed Abdul Karim, that they've been beaten, deprived of food, had their personal property stolen, and they face physical and sexual abuse. MBS has rolled out this plan called Saudization, and where Yemenis are forced to pay residency fees or face deportation, pricing out millions who came to the kingdom from Yemen to seek a better life in the wealthy Gulf monarchy. Pressure being put from all sides on these folks. And for what?
Usually people who come to Saudi Arabia who are not Saudi Arabians are second-class citizens and just are treated in that way. They're usually the domestic workers. There have been a number of Moroccan stories about sexual slaves and women escaping. So it's very consistent with how this culture has been operating, and this dare I say, the royal family, monarchy.
But MBS, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, has been touted and hailed and reported as this great reformer. Women can drive now. All must be right in the world.
Which women? No, seriously, question. Right. Only Saudi women
Talk
can
about
drive.
That,
yeah, only Saudi women can drive.
And the women who were responsible for the movement wound up being imprisoned, correct?
Right, exactly, with potentially a death penalty hanging over their head for advocating what is now legal in the country.
But at least they'll be able to drive to the gallows.
Well, there you go.
Okay, that's it. There we go. That's what we call progress.
Bittersweet.
that's what we call progress. So, based upon your research, based upon your activity, what is it that the average person listening to this show needs to know and needs to do?
Well, I think it's kind of obvious the midterm elections are coming up. And I think there has been a fair amount of grassroots advocacy on the Yemen issue. There have been, as I was telling you before I got on, I was with a group of peace activists in New York this week on Monday for their annual gala, and they have teamed up with Labor. They took advantage of our presence there during the UN General Assembly to take our materials, our posters of our Save Yemen campaign, and go to the offices of these legislators.
That's inside Arabia.
Yes, inside Arabia, exactly.
And the campaign that you all had started, and with placards on buses and
right, exactly, and mobile billboard trucks, and you know the image with the eye looking out with the reflection of the Saudi and Emirati flags in the iris, and they were telling me that they think they are getting some traction, and certainly when you have materials, we're a very visually oriented society. When you have materials that kind of get in your face and you see them every day for 2 weeks, you begin to think, wow, you know, maybe there's a problem here. But Yemen is a very far away place. And this is the danger. You know, the next thing will come along that will eclipse this problem. I mean, to some degree, Khashoggi has done that, right? But this is not going away.
When, in fact, you would have thought, because of the nexus between MBS and Yemen, you would have thought that this would have highlighted what's happening in Yemen, but it still isn't.
Right. The connection needs to continue to be drawn.
Yes.
Because Yemen may be our only leverage in terms of Shakhshi. You know, we're apparently the U.S. is not willing to leverage its arms sales, even though certain congressmen may be, you know, coming around to that. I'm not sure that the administration's ever going to get there.
Do you think the reluctance of Lindsey Graham and the others who were screaming about MBS, their reluctance to tie Yemen into this is because the United States is so deeply embedded in the problem?
Well, that probably has something to do with it. But I think that just Yemen is not really, has not been on their radar. Certain senators, the ones who sent the letter to Mike Pompeo before the certification, that the Saudis were trying to minimize the human collateral damage and civilian damage from the airstrikes so that they could continue to fuel the Saudi planes for the airstrikes. you have an awareness there, but I think still Yemen is, it needs more visibility. So your show and what I heard this morning on NPR is really what it needs, so that people can go and talk with their congresspeople and let them know that this is a serious problem, that it's not just going to be limited to Yemen. If you leave that country devastated and in chaos, what is going to come into there? It's already, you already have ISIS, you already have Al-Qaeda.
Who fills the vacuum?
Yes, right. And, you know, so some may say, well, that's why we're in this war, because we're trying to prop up the existing government. But this is not, after 3 years now, it's the end of 4 years. We're going into the fifth year, because this started in 2014. We're going into the fifth year with the coalition forces having come in big time, 9 countries originally. And we still don't have any, there's no end to the turmoil there, in terms of there's no resolution. But the only thing that's going to, the thing that has to happen before they get to a resolution is a ceasefire, definitely, to allow the humanitarian aid to get to the people, the women, the children who need it.
Elizabeth Myers, editor-in-chief of Inside Arabia. Thank you. Where can people, if they still want to see your campaign, where can they go to see your campaign?
Well, it's not running anymore on the streets of New York City, but they can certainly contact us at info@InsideArabia.com, and we'll be happy to send them our creatives.
I thought you had it online at one point.
No, okay. I do have an editorial about it, but I'll be happy to send people our creatives if they want to use them in publications, because not only are they beautiful and tragic, they're very telling.
You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Thanks to the Facebook family. Appreciate you all signing in. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.